Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So, without further ado, let's move to our first article, and this was the kind of the ultimate in the news thing this week. This morning I was greeted by a headline to Le Monde that France had withdrawn permission for doctors to use hydroxychloroquine for the COVID, and of course that was all over the news here as well. This published on May 22nd in The Lancet, an article looking at hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine with or without a macrolide for the treatment of COVID-19. It's called a multinational registry analysis. We're going to do a little science lesson on, well, among other things, it's really difficult to do good science in a hurry. And this is not really good science. And I think there's some very clear misinterpretations in the news. So I'm going to just very briefly hit those because I want you all from listening to this program to be able to look at a scientific paper and look at the abstract and be able to say to yourself, okay, this is important, or okay, maybe it's not. So this was an observational study, they called it, and a registry analysis. It's multinational, so let's take a look at that. They looked at 671 different hospitals hospitalized between December 20th, 2019 and April 14th, 2020. All of the people had a positive lab test for COVID, and they received one of the four treatments. I'll describe those in a minute, within 48 hours of diagnosis. And anyone who was in already on a ventilator or who was treated after 48 hours was not considered. Those were pulled from the consideration. They did their best to match to a control group that had similar characteristics, which is critically important. As you know, there's lots of other demographic factors like age, sex, other coexisting diagnoses that make a big difference here. And the four treatment groups were chloroquine alone, chloroquine with a macrolide, usually azithromycin, hydroxychloroquine alone, that's Plaquenil, or hydroxychloroquine with a macrolide. So with those four groups, you're able to see some really interesting findings, but I don't think they mean what they appear to mean. So let's start with the fact that we have a total of 96,000 patients, which is a lot. And so small effects are going to look large when you're dealing with that kind of numbers. This has huge statistical leverage, and sometimes that can create something called an artifact. In this case, I don't think it did. I think the problem is at a different level. 15,000 people got treated of that 96,000. And I don't need to break out which one got what in the groups. The control group was about 81,000. And 11% of these people died in the hospital. Now, they did control for multiple confounding factors, age, sex, race, ethnicity, body mass index, if there were pre-existing diseases. I won't bother to list those. I think we all know them by now. And then they looked at mortality in the control group. Well, the control group had a mortality of 9.3%, and the treatment group had a mortality of 11.1%. That's a substantial difference in mortality. So let's take a look at what would be the cause of mortality from these agents, all right? The concern with this entity, both the chloroquine and the hydroxychloroquine, whether or not you throw in the macrolide, which has significance, my friends, because it affects the breakdown of the drug and therefore might make it side effects a little more intense. It also itself might have side effects, but it has the benefit of treating bacterial pneumonia and being mildly anti-inflammatory all by itself. So that was
the rationale for its inclusion. When you look at the studies, there's something called a risk ratio. It's a very important thing to understand. And it means if the normal risk is zero, how much, what's my multiplier? Normal risk is one. It's always one. So my multiplier, if my multiplier for normal risk for my treatment group is 1.5, then my risk ratio is 1.5 with the treatment. If my multiplier is 0.75, then my risk ratio is 0.75. Therefore, this drug is lowering risk, and in the previous instance, you're raising risk. I think that's clear. So moving first to the thing that we think actually is happening, and that's the arrhythmias associated with this drug. It calls it something called QT prolongation. It just slows down the refresh rate on the heart. So think about it like this. Your television has a refresh rate. Sometimes if you take a video of your television, it may be a little blinky, and that's because you're seeing the refresh rate of the tube. And so refresh rates are a thing. Heart has a refresh rate, and the QT interval is effectively a biological, it's literally the image of the heart resetting itself. It's the refresh rate on the heart muscle. Now, if the refresh rate is too slow, then the next heartbeat will actually drop into the heart before the heart's completely ready to beat again, and this can lead to irregular heartbeats. It messes up the rhythm, and it messes up the signaling, and off we go to the races. So it can be fatal. It can lead to a particular kind of atrial ventricular fibrillation, which is generally lethal. So we want to avoid that. The normal use and the normalized medical use of this is for malaria. And when it's used for malaria, people are not walking around on cardiac monitors. Typically what we do is we give them the drug, we wait until it's on board, we look at their EKG. If they don't show QT prolongation, then they can use that for their malaria. And that's one of the main ways that this drug is used. Obviously, the situation with a person who's sick with a potentially lethal virus is a little bit different. So the question is, does it help? And the answer is, yeah, the guy's got more arrhythmia. The risk ratio on this was pretty much about 1.4, 1.5. And that's not surprising. So 50% more arrhythmias than the control group. Okay, good enough. Then the death rate, this is where it's getting misinterpreted. Everybody freaked out, threw their hands up and went, oh mon Dieu, because the death rate odds ratio was about 4 to 6. That means 4 to 6 times the normal risk. That means 400 to 600% increased risk of death. Now that's substantial. But here's where the discussion is not sound, and I fault them for actually not putting it, not pointing this out and underlining it in their summary. But let's go back to those 671 hospitals, right? There is no criteria. There is no standard about how this thing should be used. And if you're a doctor and you have a supply of this, you don't want to run through your supply. You think it might help. Who are you going to pick? Well, you're going to pick the people that look sicker. And so I think the fatal flaw of this study, and the reason why we shouldn't be placing as much emphasis on it as we are, is that I think there was something that we call in statistics selection bias. And that's why we're talking about this, because it's an important concept. If you walk into a hospital and they give you a coin and say, toss this, and you get a heads and you go to the treatment group and you get a tails and you don't, that's a randomized study. And then you can draw some conclusions about the effect of the drug. But if they look at you, take your temperature, and you get the drug if you look sicker or have more findings, which is undoubtedly what was going on in these hospitals, then you're going to have a higher rate of dying. And it will have nothing to do with the cardiac arrhythmias. If it did, then the risk of dying between the two groups would be the same as the risk of arrhythmia, 1.5%. And that's in the case that the drug did nothing. It might even be lower in the arrhythmia group. So what we've got here is a study that is just a registry. It's just an it's just saying this is what happened, and they shouldn't have even run odds ratios. I don't believe that this is an appropriate form of statistics to be using for this, because the interpretation isn't sound. What they say is we are unable to confirm a benefit, and that's certainly correct. But I think that they should also say here, due to the fact that there may be selection bias, it is impossible to reach any conclusions about an increased risk of death from these agents. And by not saying that, and the fact that unfortunately we don't have a highly sophisticated group of science reporters out there reading this stuff, I think this study doesn't prove anything. And I'm really curious about the hydroxychloroquine. I'm curious about that initial study that came out in France and was also published in The Lancet, the Didier Raoult study. By the way, there was a fascinating biography and discussion of that guy in the New York Times magazine. So if you have that online, highly recommend you read it. He's really quite an iconoclast and an interesting figure. But getting back to the case at point, I'm wondering whether the reason that our commander-in-chief is taking this stuff is because he has to get tested and he knows that it makes the tests be negative. I wondered when the paper first came out, and I think if you go back to the dates and listen to the program, I said this. I'm wondering if it's just that having the hydroxychloroquine in your body interferes with the DNA amplification piece of the test. So I went looking at I guess you'd call it the package insert for two of the cartridge-based instant tests that are the same thing. They're DNA polymerase. It's just the same thing that they send to the health department or they send to Quest or LabCorp. Let's be fair. Everybody's got a test now. And they check these against a couple of drugs and some antibiotics. And the idea is if you've got something in your bloodstream, it's also in your snot. And if it interferes with the DNA testing, maybe preventing the enzyme that magnifies the viral RNA, because the way this, it's a multi-step process. You've got viral RNA on your swab. You magnify it using a augmentation procedure called
polymerase chain reaction.
DNA amplification. And first you have to turn it into DNA. So you've got an enzyme to do that, reverse transcriptase, a fussy enzyme, I might add. And not one that they're testing. So I don't know if reverse transcriptase is impacted by hydroxychloroquine. All that would mean that your test is going to be negative, even though you may have virus in there. Your test may not show it. And that would, and if our commander-in-chief knew that, then that would explain part of his desire to keep taking it, because he'll test negative. And I'm intrigued with this, and I would love to see someone do a study where they put blood levels, achievable blood levels for hydroxychloroquine in the mix of the reagent bath, and then did a test using reverse transcriptase, using some other RNA virus like influenza, and see, does it actually do that? Is it an interfering substance? Those little things come out of the woodwork and they come and they sideline you in science. And you've always got to have a 360 viewpoint. You can't be so focused forward that you don't look to the right, look to the left, and imagine A, unintended consequences, and B, maybe there's something that's stepping on your endpoint, which in the case of this has always been positivity in the nasal swab. And I've actually not seen that replicated either. So who knows? But it was interesting. Now we're going to go to our first email. And that is from Dan in Monterey. Low-dose naltrexone for peripheral neuropathy. Dear Dr. Doan, I was diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy in 2008 and had never heard of low-dose naltrexone until today. Everything I quote-unquote know about it comes from Googling. Many anecdotes claim it is helpful for peripheral neuropathy. I'm currently taking gabapentin, nortriptyline, and pregabalin. Anything you can add would be appreciated. Well, the first thing I want to do, Dan, is thank you very much for asking this question, because, and this is one of the reasons I love doing this program and love my audience, is they teach me. And Dan, thank you for the lesson, because I did go looking in Google Scholar, and I found lots of good, solid evidence that this is a thing, and a thing that you probably should be doing. And I have to say, after reading these articles, I'm going to change my approach to chronic pain and look into putting all of my chronic pain and neuropathic pain patients on a combination of the two drugs that you mentioned, the gabapentin and the pregabalin. I kind of see as pretty much to the same drug. I generally don't have people on both because it feels redundant to me. But getting back to our articles, so naltrexone is a FDA-approved drug, and it is the first cousin to naloxone. Naloxone is has to be given by injection, or it can be given nasally. And GABA and naloxone does not work orally. Naltrexone is its first cousin and can be taken orally and does cross the blood-brain barrier. And it primarily has an FDA indication for maintaining sobriety in alcoholism and other substance abuse disorders. It has a very, very good evidence that it does help. It helps with the cravings. And so once a person becomes sober and has gone through their rehab and is no longer using, they can lower their cravings. And also the phenomenon I call booze calls to booze. So you hear about this from people who've been alcoholics for a long time sober, and they're afraid if they take one drink that they'll take a second and a third and a fourth. And indeed, that, of course, is the observable outcome in many cases, and is one of the primary dictums of most of the Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotic Anonymous groups. It is potentially modified by the use of naltrexone, and so a small amount of social drinking, a glass of champagne at your daughter's wedding, you know, at that level, if you have the drug on board, may work. And certainly the repetitive cravings are lessened. It's not a miracle drug. It's an adjunct, and it does improve the maintenance of sobriety. That's at 50 milligrams a day. We're talking about repurposing it and giving like a tenth of that, or less than a tenth of that. And why would such a small dose work? And the answer is it's doing something completely different. And what it's doing is affecting something called toll-like receptor number 4. Let me tell you about toll-like receptors. They're all over your body. They're intimately involved in inflammation. As far as that goes, they're intimately involved in COVID. They're one. They're found in all bacteria, and the toll-like compounds that inhabit and activate the receptor are found in all bacteria, and they're called lipopolysaccharides. So as bacteria die and fragment, small fragments of their cell wall act like a lock and key mechanism on toll-like receptors, and this causes, among other things, the migration of white blood cells to the site of infection, and can also, when they are massively activated, lead to massive overinflammation, like, oh yeah, that thing, the cytokine storm that we've been hearing so much about. But this toll-like receptor does something completely different. It's actually largely found on the protective cells, the glia cells. The glia cells are supportive, and they are part of the immune system of the nervous system. They are, however, inflammatory. And when you activate the glial cells, you initiate a series of processes that change the way the spinal cord nerves work and create a cycle of increased pain sensitivity. Now, how silly is that? How maladaptive is that? You have pain, and your endorphins should shut the pain down and make it so that you can experience the pain and then say, all right, that's enough of that, and you know, run away from the predator or whatever. But if the pain remains chronic for too long, the nerves actually reset themselves. And rather than damping the pain, they augment it. And that's what gets us into chronic pain situations. So Dan didn't tell us why he has peripheral neuropathy. There are three really common causes. One is alcoholism and B vitamin deficiency that results from that. One is diabetes and inflammation and damage to the small blood vessels that support the nerves that eventually lead to an inflammatory state that locks itself in. And a third is heavy metal poisoning. It's a feature of things like lead and mercury that you'll get neuropathy from them. And I see a lot of all three of these conditions, and these cover a lot of the neuropathies that we see. The mechanism, physiologically, the damage is coming from a different source, but the response is the same. And so the use of low-dose naltrexone, which is in the natural medicine world referred to as LDN, is a very, very effective way to help. And these studies show that. So I've got links, and I will go ahead and forward those to Dan so that Dan can take them into his doctor and see about getting this prescribed by his doctor. It's not available in pills. You have to get it compounded, but any physician can write a compounded prescription for this. And in my experience, and according to the medical literature, it's very, very safe. You know, think about it. If you can give it at 50 milligrams a day, you can probably give it at 3 milligrams a day and have, if anything, fewer side effects and adverse events. And why doesn't more work better? Because that kind of logic, it does not operate in biology. So what else does it work for? Well, it works for something that is a hideous disease. It's neuropathic pain. And complex regional pain syndrome is sometimes called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, is a neuroinflammatory condition that is so difficult to treat. It is a weird combination. We see it often in people with spinal cord injuries. It also occurs as a kind of horrible variant of phantom limb pain. And people will, and the one of the things that is so awful about this is that it can be caused by fairly trivial injuries that people should have been able to recover from without events. But something goes wrong in the programming, and you get this locked-in loop, and eventually it leads to color change, temperature change, loss of hair, loss of sensation, increased pain and loss of sensation. What a bad combination of things to have, right? Eventually, you can't even give nerve blocks. They stop working. All conventional analgesics and opiates and the anticonvulsants, like the drugs that Dan's taking, and the antidepressants. He's also taking a tricyclic antidepressant there in the form of the nortriptyline. And these are all standard therapies because what do they all do? They calm down nerves. And this nerve is being artificially accelerated by this toll-like receptor 4. So you can show that a combination of oral naltrexone reduces chronic pain in fibromyalgia. And some of my fibromyalgia patients sort of have a problem with pain augmentation, probably related to inflammation in the TL4-related pathway. So it's all coming together, all of these weird chronic burny-type nerve pains with no apparent cause all have an evidently demonstrated cause and handles we can pull on to actually help. So you can use this for diabetic neuropathy. You can use it in spinal cord injury. You can use it in complex regional pain syndrome. And it also works with acupuncture. So when we are trying to treat, let's say, a quote-unquote failed back, when I'm trying to treat this in the future using my acupuncture techniques, whose goal is, in fact, to reset these spinal gates, literally reprogram them using low-frequency electrical stimulation, I can now make that work better and hopefully faster by adding in low-dose naltrexone. So, Dan, not only do I thank you for pointing out this path and leading me down the primrose path to finding a new therapeutic modality, and that's exciting, but also I hope it will encourage others to ask questions, because maybe you'll get your answer, but you may actually benefit others. And I was listening to a woman today who is a plasma donor, and she was talking about donating plasma, convalescent plasma, because she was an exchange student in Italy and got COVID, and she's been able to actually help save people by donating her blood to people who are in the intensive care unit. And it's not hard to donate plasma. It doesn't make you anemic, because they put the red blood cells back in, so you can do it weekly, and your system just regenerates these antibodies. And what a wonderful superpower. I mean, it's almost like one of those Marvel comic book heroes, right? My blood is a cure for a disease. It's really amazing. So you could have that level of satisfaction, or at least a little warm fuzzy, knowing, Dan, that you are going to help me treat people's pain. Before I go to the next email, a couple of observations. You probably all saw the news that we've had a bump in cases. We're now just around 200. We've got a number of contact tracing has kind of pinpointed that this was Mother's Day. These were Mother's Day parties, and there was also a family reunion, and it's not known, but may not be surprise anybody to imagine that maybe at a family reunion, you might hug and maybe plant a kiss on somebody's cheek, and that feels really normal and like a huge relief, but it can backfire, and it did. The other thing that I want to talk about is a little darker than that, which is to say that people need to respect other people's opinions, and they need not to threaten others or act in coercive fashions. I've seen and heard about some of that lately, and it's deeply disturbing to me. We need to be united and kind, and we need to take our frustrations where we normally take our frustrations and not injure or threaten to injure others because we're frustrated. That is just not okay any time, but it's especially not okay right now. All right, I'll get back off my soapbox. On to our next email, and this one from Sandra. UV to disinfect house and vitamin D and K together. Can you please comment on machines advertised as such as the link below? My home has a lot of light, so perhaps it's not needed. Perhaps good for other friends and family who might be living in dark time. Also, can you please comment on using vitamin D and vitamin K together? Certainly, Sandra. I'm going to take the second part of your question first, because it's easier. I highly recommend using supplemental vitamin D, even though it's nice and warm and sunny out there, and you may be getting a fair amount of sun. I've certainly got the best upper body tan I've had in 30 years. I'm normally a bit stuck inside most of the day. But getting your vitamin D level up to, I would say, 50 to 60 may, in fact, benefit you. Certainly getting your vitamin D level out of deficiency will benefit you. We talked about that story last week. So with respect to vitamin K, in the intestine, one of the actions of vitamin D is to help the intestine absorb calcium. And that's good. But we all know that calcium doesn't have a homing beacon on it. And if we want to send it to our bones and not to our arteries, we might want to take a little extra vitamin K, especially vitamin K2. There's a subset of vitamin K2 called MK7, which may be the best subset. It has the best data, which is not the same thing, because you can just invent something and sell it and do testing to show that it's good, but you may not necessarily test it against your competitors. In fact, big pharma almost never does. So the same thing happens in the nutritional world. But we do know that vitamin K, and particularly vitamin K2, helps your body direct the calcium that you absorb away from your arteries and into your bones. So I highly recommend it. You may also have heard of vitamin K as a reversal agent for the coumarin group. That's Coumadin and some of the other, and warfarin, some of the other chemicals that are sometimes used as rat poison, but are sometimes used therapeutically in humans with, among other things, atrial fibrillation or pulmonary emboli to help them not get another clot and end up with a stroke or a problem in their lungs. This agent can be reversed by vitamin K, but just taking vitamin K does not make your blood clot more. That only happens if you're on a blood thinner and it reverses it. So you can think of it as an antidote for a blood thinner, but not a procoagulant. And that's a mistake people often make. It is perfectly safe to take extra vitamin K. The other question is a little more complicated. So I'm looking right now at the website that Sandra sent, and it's a small handheld device that is a light bulb, and it's bright blue. And we've got this person wearing a mask and wearing gloves holding it. So, you know, they're obviously trying to evoke our current situation. And it's framed as a blog post about, you know, the fact that there are germs in your purse and that there are germs on handrails and doorknobs. And I think we all know that. And then they talk about buying their device and how that's going to destroy up to 99% of germs. And they show a picture, and they're really talking, I think, about bacteria here. But it is true that UVC does kill viruses. They all go on to say that you could use it for your glasses, your remote controls, your tablets and your pens, et cetera, et cetera. So it's being framed as something that's going to protect you during its short 30-minute cycle. And so let's talk about UVC, because only ultraviolet C will do this. And how accurate are the claims made on this website? And should you go out and buy a UVC device? So just talking a little bit about ultraviolet radiation as a purification technique. There's not much UVC down here on the surface of the Earth, because the atmosphere, the ozone layer in particularly, blocks it. Remember the ozone hole? Well, that's why we were so worried about the ozone hole, because people who were under the ozone hole were getting a lot of ultraviolet C, and this is the one that damages DNA very efficiently. That's how it sterilizes things. It destroys DNA. Well, if it destroys your DNA, you can get cancer. So it is not a cure-all. It goes all the way back to 1878. It's kind of a cool little science fun fact. And the Nobel Prize in Medicine in
1903
was awarded to a guy named Niels Feinsen for figuring out how to use UVC against tuberculosis of the skin. It probably gave him cancer 10 years later, but of course the Nobel Prize was already awarded, and I guess they don't take it back. But it's been used for water purification now for a very, very long time, all the way back to the 50s. And a lot of this article that I'm looking at right now on Wikipedia talks about that. So you've got mercury-based lamps that are low vapor and they emit UV. You've got light-emitting diodes that emit UV at selectable wavelengths, 255 to 280. So you're getting down into the range. And there is something called pulse xenon. So if you get above the 280, then you're talking about UVB. And UVB gets through the ozone layer and gets down to the surface, and that's what gives us sunburn, which can also damage DNA, but not as efficiently or effectively. as UV. Well, where can you use UV? Well, you can use it on line of sight. So basically, if you want to sterilize that remote, you're going to have to put 30 minutes on the front of the remote and then flip it over and put 30 minutes on the back of the remote. Ditto for your glasses, because you're going to have to get the sides and the insides of the earpieces. And with your phone, you're going to have to flip it again. So I think the ad sort of implies that you just put your phone on the table, turn the thing on. You've got 30 seconds to get out of the room. Oh, by the way, did I mention that UVC will make you go blind? It's extremely dangerous in that context. So how long and how much energy is delivered is key. So we got a nice little chat bot. Well, no, it wasn't a bot, actually. I think the first person might have been a bot, but then we asked a technical question, and we got an actual human. Hi, my name is Maria. I really appreciate you reaching out to us. Yes, our device is UVC. Is there anything else I can help you with? Yes, can you give me the nanometer wavelength values for your product? I've been reading that far UV 207 to 222 is safer. UVC has a wavelength of 110 to 280. Most acrylic plastics allow light wavelength greater than 375 nanometers to pass through the material. Is there anything else I can help you with? No. Well, we got one more answer from them. They told us that the device was delivering 1 joule for a cubic centimeter. And I don't know what the duration is to deliver that, but it certainly would not be instantaneous. So what we're left here with is a device that is a high ultraviolet. It does get down into the range that we would want to possibly sterilize virus or bacteria, but you're going to have to rotate the device, and you have to ask yourself, what is the device I'm using? Will this work for masks? Maybe. It depends on how thick the mask is. Because you have a line of sight, and then the devil's always in the details, isn't it? I would not recommend purchasing this device, even though it's only $70. I don't think I'm not sure that it will work. I'm not sure that we have the appropriate dose here, and unfortunately, since they gave it to us in joules and Wikipedia gives it to me in watts, I am having a little trouble, watts times exposure time, I'm having a little trouble doing the conversion. Anybody out there who wants to do that conversion for me, please do so. So how do I convert microwatts seconds, or maybe it's microwatts per centimeter squared, to joules per times seconds to joules? If you can tell me, then maybe I'll be able to tell our emailer whether or not this device would in fact actually work. I also need to give a credit to to my producer, Charles Mansky, who chatted with the chat box, and he said they did not answer any questions about intensity. So I guess the 1 joules I have here in my notes probably came from the Wikipedia article, and I just didn't, and I misattributed it, because as I do these things, I actually write on paper, because paper sometimes it still really rocks. And we're going to move on to some other topics. This one I thought a nice change of pace. Heated water in the gut may help treat diabetes. And this one is just news of the weird, but it actually probably would work. And it looks like maybe a really solid thing to attempt. Now, this is a preliminary study, and we don't know about complications, but people have been using heated water in balloons in medicine for a while now, and doing things like treating women's uteruses when they have excessive bleeding by burning the inside of the uterus using a balloon of hot water. It takes about So this procedure is called Revita, R-E-V-I-T-A, and it uses water heated to 75 degrees centigrade Celsius, which is not going to, is not less than boiling, and it uses it to, and they have people effectively swallow a balloon, and they maneuver it down to the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. And then they blow it up and they fill it with hot water, and it burns the lining of the duodenum, which interferes with the property of that tissue to make a hormone. Naturally, when you burn tissue, it loses a lot of its more sophisticated properties. And so the gastric inhibitory polypeptide is no longer made. And this GIP, we know, is very important in controlling how we metabolize nutrients. It's enhanced. It's higher in people with diabetes. And so they get upregulated levels of GIP, which gives them insulin resistance and also causes them to gain more weight, which fuels the insulin resistance. So in a study done on 300 people, this was in the UK, three European countries, and Brazil, and they started about 2 years ago. And in the two-year group, right now there's another 280 people who are in the study, but they published on the first group. They were able to get their hemoglobin A1C to fall from 8.5 to 7.5, and they had a randomized 70-person trial. Half the people got sham treatment, so they thought they were getting the real treatment, swallowed the balloon, went through the procedure, and they found that those who got the actual procedure within 3 months had improvements on glucose control and markers of liver health. So it reversed some of the non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, sometimes called NASH syndrome, that people who are overweight and or diabetic often get. And they lost about 3 kilograms. That's 6.6 pounds. Not massive, but it certainly is things heading in the right direction. And so if people alter their diet, they can probably cure their diabetes. Of course, if they just alter their diet, many people can substantially reverse their diabetes and become what we call diet-controlled diabetics. But it's a device. It's a therapeutic. It's a therapeutic device that costs money to purchase. It will get potentially approved by various countries and then covered by the health programs or the insurance companies in those countries. So you've got a profit margin. You've got a carbon cycle, effectively, for this thing to actually happen and be funded and eventually become therapeutic. I think it's probably a better idea than gastric bypass, which has a much more profound effect on the digestive system and effectively causes severe long-term inability to absorb certain vitamins. And, you know, there's a lot that goes on in the duodenum from the excretory pathway, releasing hormones, releasing other compounds that feed back on the digestive system. But there's also a lot that goes on in terms of absorption of nutrients, amino acids, proteins, lipids. A study like this, if you're looking around doing that 360 view I talked about earlier, where you're thinking about how could this go wrong? What could I be missing? Well, one of the things you could really be missing was vitamin deficiencies. You might find that frying the duodenum causes scurvy or one of the other known nutritional deficiencies. I'd have to look up and see what's known about what gets absorbed in the duodenum, but it's very probable that you would knock out absorptive capacity, and maybe that would cause other long-term problems. Plus, it might affect the absorption of medications, and I don't think anybody's even thought that through. But drugs that are absorbed at a neutral pH won't get absorbed in the stomach. They'll get absorbed in the duodenum, and so many drugs might actually just go right through you if they depended on that upper duodenum for absorption. We've got time to talk about fever. And the most common cause of fever is infection. And what happens is that when immune cells, and this would be your innate immunity, first recognize the signs of a germ, and that would be the lipopolysaccharides attaching to toll-like receptors on the surface of the white blood cell, they start secreting compounds that have an immediate effect. These are called pyrogens, P-Y-R-O-gens, and they go to a part of the brain called the hypothalamus, which is your thermostat. And the hypothalamus can control all, it's like the master puppet for physiology. So the hypothalamus, among other things, will send signals to cause heat-boosting responses. So the blood vessels in your skin are going to constrict so that you can't sweat, you can't lose heat from the surface of your body. That's why the fever breaks when you sweat. That's why inducing a sweat, if you can get, can actually lower fever. The fat cells start burning energy, so you start doing lipolysis, and that creates heat, thermic energy. The muscles start contracting, that shivering sensation, or just tightening up, and that's the early stage of it. All of these warm us up, and the body temperature goes up. And too high is not good. There is a Goldilocks zone, just like there are for life in the universe. There's a Goldilocks zone for fever, where your cells are protected and the virus and bacterial cells are disadvantaged. And that zone is, you know, somewhere between normal and about 103. When we see temperatures above 40 degrees centigrade or 104, we want to bring that thing down. But I think and would encourage you to not view all fever as a bad thing. Fever probably helps you fight off viruses. And getting your body temperature up, particularly if you can raise your core temperature, to about 101, 105, 101, it's not that uncomfortable, and it's very effective. I have a tendency, I've been a doctor for many years, and I've been exposed, and there's that little coming down with something feeling that one gets. You're a little bit tired, maybe a little bit achy, just off, but it isn't severe. And maybe you've got a slight, raspy throat or a little bit of pain when you swallow. That's basically the moment to go heat yourself up. And I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that. I've had a spa in my home for many years. It's tiny. I'm not heating up the neighborhood too much with it, but it is definitely what my go-to is when I think I'm coming down with something. So I'm in favor of low-grade fevers. Children will sometimes get away from you. And so fevers in children can rapidly spike. And when the fever gets above 104, you have a much increased risk of seizure. Actually, when the fever is changing quickly, which adults don't do, but kids can do really easily, they're putting out more pyrogens and their hypothalamus just goes for it. And so you can actually benefit people by giving them the fever. And the question is not to do so high. Here's a study, 72 kids, all with chickenpox. Half of them were not given antipyretics like aspirin or ibuprofen. And the ones who got placebo got better faster. Another study here, people deliberately infected with one of the common cold virus. If you took fever-reducing drugs, you stayed infectious for longer. Oh, that's pretty interesting right now with asymptomatic people who are walking around without making pyrogens. Certainly, if you're starting to have a fever, you want to immediately, at least in this place, you want to self-isolate and monitor that fever. But we do know that COVID as well, all of the coronaviruses, slow down when they're exposed to higher than normal body temperatures. And you know what else happens? some of the immune cells actually speed up. The macrophages and the neutrophils, which are the first responders, have an increased capacity to phagocytize with the temperature between 38 and 40. So they also release more of the chemicals that activate T cells, the ones that cause that adaptive immune response, and they also activate plasma cells, the ones that already have the programming for your antibodies. Another study that was published last year showed that if you've got a temperature of 40 degrees centigrade, which I believe, I'm doing this in my head, is around 101.8, the T cells that are in your bloodstream are able to extravasate or pass, they pass through the cell wall of the capillary beds. They're able to get out of the bloodstream and into the tissue more easily because the fever causes the blood vessels themselves to make grappling hooks, to make handles, basically. It's like if you're a rock climber and you come across a python when you really need one, it's like, oh, I'll just grab onto this. And then you feel a lot better. Well, if you are a T cell wandering around and you see signs of an infection, you've got a python to hook onto because the fever has caused the blood cells wall to sprout them. Now, isn't that cool? Unfortunately, we have no more time for cool science. We've come to the end of the hour. This is Dr. Don saying thank you for listening. Please check out AskDrDon.com. Please come back next week. So long and stay healthy.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.